Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Rachel Neighbors. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you, Scott?
I am lovely, and I'm happy to talk to you. The last time we did a podcast was about 3 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
And yeah, you were doing CSS consulting, and you were speaking all over the world, and the web was a different web. I think it was a little bit of a different web three or four years ago. And I'm looking at your blog under rachelneighbors.com/about at all your interviews and your workshops and your conference schedule. You're doing a lot of really fun stuff.
I sure am. Although now I am stepping back into more of a making things role again, which pleases me greatly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all feel better when we're making stuff, and then we kind of go back and forth between making stuff and talking about stuff and making stuff and talking about stuff.
It's true. You have to have something to talk about. Otherwise, what are you doing up there?
Mm-hmm. And back in the day, it was three years ago we talked, but you've been doing the web for many, many, many years. You had a thought about a book, and then this book is now out here in 2017, and you wrote this article about it on your site, Animation at Work, and you called the article, "The Web Animation Book I Wish I'd Had 5 Years Ago." It's yours. You've written a book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's been a lifelong dream of mine to write a book, especially with my favorite publisher, A Book Apart. It's like, these are the books that I grew up on. So it just thrills me utterly to finally have published with the publisher whose books helped me through my very first foray into front-end development.
Yeah, that's fantastic. If you go to Animation at Work, you'll get linked eventually over to abookapart.com. There's all kinds of great books there. They call the website Brief Books for people who make websites, and your book is there. And of course, you've also been so kind as to make a coupon for people who are listening to the show.
Yes, you can get 10% off with Hansel. That's all caps, H-A-N-S-E-L, named for our good host here. You can get 10% off the book. And if you decide you would like to take some awesome courses on, say, CSS animations and transitions, or how to put practical cartooning skills to work in your daily communications, you can get 10% off with that same H-A-N-S-E-L coupon code at courses.rachelneighbors.com.
That's pretty fantastic. And the course, particularly on CSS animation, has a lot of stuff going on. It's, you know, lots and lots of videos and practical understanding about how CSS animation, sequencing, performance, all those things fit together into an effective animation.
Absolutely. I like to say that it's the perfect partner to the book. The book is all about the theory and the how. Well, not the how. The book is all about the theory, how the human brain processes animations, visual input, period, and when it's appropriate to use them in your web and web app designs. Or actually, I know some people who've been putting these lessons to work in their app development and even their slide deck development. Mm-hmm. So it turns out what I wrote was actually a lot more useful than I anticipated. There's even great stuff in here about how to normalize animations across a system so that you can incorporate them into your style guides and design systems.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I was impressed about, and I know that this is a thing that A Book Apart cares about and that you care about, is that the book is very affordable. It's an $8 ebook, but it's still got a lot of detail. Was it hard to decide to do an ebook that was that inexpensive as opposed to like a $50 giant, like the Web Animation Bible, smack?
So glad you asked me that, because originally when I was like, I'm going to write a book, it is about everything I have ever known about animation and extra research included. Mm-hmm. And that was the book that I pitched. A Book Apart. It was like, I want to write the tome. And they came back and they were like, not for us. Sorry. But if you'd like to know why, we're happy to talk with you. And of course, I was all heartbroken and no, my submission was rejected. Why would they do that? But anytime people give you a negative reaction or the reaction you don't want, that is an opportunity to learn something. So they were offering to talk to me, you know, spend their time on me for free to tell me something about why they'd made a decision. And I was like, I got to get in on that. So I was like, tell me, I want to hear what it was about this that wasn't floating your boat. It might help me make this an even better submission package for another publisher, or might help me write it and self-publish it even better. So I reached out to them and we had a long conversation. It turns out all of their issues with the book were actually my issues too, because by the time I had finished writing the submission package, I was like, maybe I don't want to write the big book of animation because there's still so much undiscovered out there. There's still much research that needs to be done. There's still many people who are going to accomplish great things and are going to have great things to say. Who am I to come in and be like, I have all the answers right here, right now? That would be a little premature. In fact, I've even seen some folks who end up in an industry being set up as an expert. They make big claims early, and then later on, we learn better. But their claims are still held up because they were put out there first. So misinformation can have a lasting effect in a community. And I really didn't want to add to that. I wanted to make sure that I was actually covering what we know now, what I'd learned from working in this field for 5 years, and set the stage for us to move on to other greater things down the line.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that I like about the book is that it's not necessarily just a list of CSS properties and stuff, although it does talk to you about like the anatomy of a web animation. You talk about easing and duration and things like that. But you talk about like why we do animation in the first place and like why does the brain work the way it works. And you talk about something interesting that I had never heard of, change blindness.
Oh, yeah. So when you... Change blindness often happens to those of us who work at computers because we are staring at this one focal point for so long that things can be happening left or right and we might not actually notice that they are occurring. You know, if you've ever had your spouse or someone have to wave their hand in front of your face while you've been working, probably because you didn't notice them out of the corner of your eye. People can become change blind. They don't notice when something is moving or changing in their peripheral vision. So you have to catch their attention, often by increasing something's animacy or how alive it appears. So if someone's staring at a screen and you want them to look in a bucket or at an icon or something, you might shake that icon or cause it to expand and contract, kind of pop them out of that tunnel vision and attract their attention over to something else. We've seen this a lot with those horrible shaky ads from back in the 90s.
I try to forget as much of the 90s as possible, including most of the animations that were written in Flash in the 90s. So I'm going to have to apologize for that one.
It's okay. I think we were all scarred by those.
It was a difficult time for all of us, I'm afraid.
But gotta say, like the Flash developers, even though Flash is dead, I keep meeting them running really wonderful interaction agencies around the world. So yeah. I hope that their spirit and their cleverness transforms in different locations throughout the industry.
Yep, exactly. I think that we all learned how to animate on the web because of Flash and what they called Future Wave or Future Splash before it. Like without, you know, the Dreamweavers and the Future Splashes, we would never have animated anything. It would all just be a big giant hypertext book.
Absolutely. And I don't know about you, but this is the internet. When I was growing up, it was not pitched to me as glorified microfiche. It was supposed to be like the conduit of human interaction. And there's so much more to human interaction than just text.
Yeah. The one thing I was interested in understanding is how you think animation is going to go forward on the web, given that the things you were doing 3 or 4 years ago were kind of like polyfilled. I mean, maybe I'm using the wrong terms. Like you were doing things with animation when there weren't necessarily standards for them. And now people are talking about those standards. You've worked on some of those standards.
Yes, I have.
Are they simply allowing us to do things that we could do 3 years ago, except with less markup? Like, or are we still doing the same things we did in Flash, except now it's one property instead of an entire Flash?
Well, That's interesting that you should ask about that. So partly, yes, some of the stuff is no longer polyfilled or behind vendor prefixes, and we've advanced in that regard. But on the other hand, some things have become more popular. For instance, most front-end developers or designers who want to build interactions, not just like animations, but actual, like anything from making an icon change, to creating an interactive visual data visualization, or, you know, making a really cute, kind of almost like a flash video using CSS and JavaScript. There are libraries that are kind of now industry standards, like GrainSock is one of them. It's a tweening library that was written in ActionScript, rewritten in JavaScript, and it's the most popular animation library on the web now, top 20 JavaScript libraries. Yeah.
Really?
So we've seen it's a blinding amount of change in this space over the past 3 years. And I think at one point I wrote an article on A List Apart where I said that we're going to see that prototyping software that invests in animation is going to compete better than prototyping software that doesn't. I was speaking specifically about the web, but this also applies to app development. And it's true. Those prototyping companies that didn't get a good animation workflow nailed down, they weren't able to also grab the app development market as well. And even juggernauts like InVision quickly adopted and bought out people who were building animation tools online and added them into their stables so that they could provide that feature. Anyone who didn't do that just isn't even competing right now.
Really?
Yeah, motion design is a big part of making fully integrated, smoothly flowing experiences. You don't really have a touch strategy without a motion designer on your staff right now.
Do you think that if we make motion animations available in like single properties and simple things like that, they'll just be abused? Like if you give me those tools, I'm just going to mess it up.
It's funny you should say that, because that would be like me saying, well, if I give you more fonts, won't you just change every font on the page and make it ugly? And yeah, that can happen.
yeah, I mean, ultimately it all turns into Comic Sans.
But eventually people, let's put it this way. If you were doing that, you wouldn't be building anything anyone would want to use, so no one will see it. Does a tree falling in the woods really make a noise? Does a poorly designed experience ever really get seen by anybody? So I'm not worried at all that people are going to abuse it, because if they do, no one will use it.
Okay. I can see that. I can see that. I know that I'm going to mess it up, though, ultimately. But
I will say there are some best practices. There are some things that people can do to not horribly ruin their user's experience. For instance, in the CSS world, we have this new thing that the Apple people proposed, good folks working on WebKit. It's a reduced motion media query. Now, it's non-standard. It's been proposed, but it's not been implemented by every browser everywhere right now. It's definitely Safari only. But basically what it does is, if the user has gone into their preferences and selected, you know, reduce motion, then this media query will respect it. It means that you can dump all of your CSS animations to be under that media query so that people who suffer from vestibular disorders won't have to suffer through your animations. It also offers a couple of other benefits, like you can loop into that with JavaScript and only conditionally load a parallax library and all of its triggers if that motion preference is set in a way that allows it.
Interesting. And so I would set that just like I set my do not track in my browser. I mean, it's a preference. I would tell the browser, I get vertigo, I get dizziness.
It's actually a system level setting really? For iOS and I don't know actually if it's on desktop, but it's a system level setting on iOS, and now iOS Safari respects it. So it's lovely to see all the browsers are contributing something special.
That's very interesting. I wonder, I know that there is a play animations on Windows option on Windows itself.
Yes.
And I wonder if that is then respected and then goes all the way through the browser. And
not at this time.
Okay, but certainly could, because it's a flag and it just needs to find its way through the stack.
Exactly. I have high hopes for that one, because it really does change the usability of the web and apps that are built on top of web technologies.
Yeah, I definitely noticed the one in iOS that's like, you know, use less motion. I don't know if it uses no motion, but it's like, don't use the motion that's going to give me vertigo.
Okay, right.
Interesting.
And now, that feeling of vertigo is what we call, I may have used a word that some of your audience members are like, what?
Vestibular
disorder. It's a thing where your vestibular system is the thing that controls your sense of balance. And when it goes out of whack, and it involves your eyes, it involves your ears, it involves a lot of different parts of things. And when it gets a little out of whack in any particular way, everyone's a little out of whack in a different way if they're suffering from a vestibular disorder, you can feel vertigo from things like parallax motion, where things in the foreground are moving faster than things in the background, which is very popular in design right now. And that can throw people at odds. You know, they can feel like they're going to vomit because, you know, something's moving that and it shouldn't be.
Really? Now, no disrespect to people who have this, but as someone who doesn't currently have any, I've had vertigo in the past, but I don't have it right now. Is this a big deal? Is this like this is an accessibility issue? Like, I want to make my website work for the blind, even though there's not a whole ton of blind people. There's certainly a measurable and significant amount, and we care about them. We want to make our videos have captioning for the hard of hearing. But I don't think we're necessarily as familiar with vestibular disorders as we are blindness and deafness. Like, at what point, you know, at what point do we go too far, and when do we stop and when do we start? Like, is this an easy thing to do?
That is a great.
I'm kind of dancing around it. Like, I know that I'm going to get an email from someone with a vestibular order that's like, yes, it's totally real. But I understand that. Like, you know, I don't eat cake. I'm diabetic. I get that. Like, we want the web to be accessible. Is it just a matter of having a flag and then just simply not animating the things that I would ordinarily animate?
Well, the media queries are a way to do that. But right now, the problem is that not everybody, that is to say everyone but Safari at this time, doesn't support them. So your other option is to do something like what I did with this project I did with Mozilla back in the day. Show Off Firefox is excellent, and they are still best-in-class web animation tools. Oh. You should totally check out devtoolschallenger.com. Mm-hmm. This was such an exciting project. It was we had 5 weeks, and there were just five of us, and I was like lead creative director person and chasing down awesome illustrators all over Portland. We got these beautiful deep-sea fish, and it's a tutorial for how to use the tools. But you'll notice that there's also a call to action on the page. It's like to turn off the animations. It's right there with the turn down the sound option. So we like to give users options these days. I think what we keep getting back to when having these discussions around accessibility and is there such a thing as accessible by default, and the truth is there's no such thing as accessible by default. We are all on some continuum of different abilities. Some of us can see better than we can hear. Some of us hear better than we can see. Some of us get dizzy when we see things moving on a page. And for others of us, it really helps us figure out where things are on the page. So you can't just say, all right, the computers are now completely non-visual, because that doesn't help the people who have problems hearing. You can't say, well, we're going to remove all the animation, because then we lose all the cognitive benefits that animation confers on people who don't have vestibular disorders.
Interesting.
So what we're seeing as a trend in app and web design is giving users options. And if there's no system level setting that you can respect for contrast, that's a great feature, by the way, for contrast or reduced motion preferences, we try to offer it in another way. I specifically love it when sites offer, for instance, in their user settings, like big corporate or governmental sites, in their user settings, if they have a box you can tick to use a font that's designed specifically to help people with dyslexia read the screen. It's not a font that's easy to read for people who do not have dyslexia. Yes, but for those folks that do have it, that's a major feature boost. But you're not forcing this on everybody, because there's nothing that's perfect for everybody. You're just giving people choice in how they experience the web.
Yeah. I'm going to have to apologize for about 10 minutes ago when I was talking about that. I did not realize that when you think about vestibular disorders, you're also thinking about epilepsy, which I am familiar with. And I understand that there are people who have had their epileptic seizures triggered by, you know, something as innocuous as an ad. Like you just, mm-hmm. you're deciding to read the news and you go to a page and then suddenly there's an advertisement and then you're having a seizure because someone was thoughtless.
And this, unfortunately, been used as a weapon against some people on Twitter. I've seen threads where someone's being a horrible troll to a person who's known to have epilepsy and will tweet triggering GIFs at them on purpose. And that's really sickening.
Really?
And
that's not cool.
Yeah, no. But epilepsy is not a vestibular disorder. It's just another one of those different cognitive quirks that some people have and some people don't, and you want to be respectful of them. I would say that epilepsy is a very dangerous one because while vertigo can make you feel dizzy, you're unlikely to fall over and die in the street in front of oncoming traffic because of vertigo. Unlikely. Didn't say it can't happen. Just saying most cases of vestibular disorders are not that extreme. Whereas epilepsy, when it hits, can have devastating consequences in an active environment.
How much of this do you talk about in the book where you have the chapters on human perception and animation? Because you go through how the human visual system works and kind of the cognitive load of animation.
We actually save these for the last chapter because the last chapter of the book is all about accessibility. And I feel like accessibility is a wonderful field of research and people are constantly diving deep and learning more and more about how the brain works. And a lot of these things, we don't even know that they're a problem until they are. For instance, iOS 7 had a zooming in and out animation that the designers didn't even realize that that would be a problem because all the people they tested on were very positive and, you know, hey, this animation helps me see where my apps are from. I'm one of those people. And that helped them find those apps again later. It decreased their cognitive load. They didn't have to stop and think about where those apps were because it was reinforced every time they accessed and exited it. Now, what they didn't realize was just a few weeks after launch, there were all these negative reports coming in of people feeling dizzy and, you know, like trying to pull back their installations because they didn't like this animation. So the iOS developers pushed out that prefers reduced motion toggle as an immediate response to their users' needs.
Interesting. Okay. Do you put these toggles on all of your sites? Like I'm looking at your Challenger one, but I have to say I have not seen a lot of those.
I haven't either, but I think my next site I will put it on there. And I will also have the media query. If I'll use a little bit of JavaScript to detect if the media query isn't supported, put this toggle on the page somewhere.
Mm-hmm. On your site at Rachel Nabors, and Nabors is Nabors, you have a section called Alice in Videoland. It's basically an interactive storybook. And it's a couple of years old now, isn't it?
It is. I made this for Adobe's Inspire magazine back when it was all about the web. Mm-hmm. And this book was from an era when Flash animation just wasn't being done. And everyone was being really into the more typographic, stateful web. You know, it all looked very beautiful and magazine-like. Unfortunately, could have looked more magazine-like. Now we have Grid. Come back, everyone. Try it again. But anyway, I made this to kind of prove that you could have an interactive storybook using CSS and JavaScript only, and it would still work on an iPad. It could look really good, in fact.
Yeah.
And it's been a while. What I'm doing now is I'm taking this site, which has a lot of cruft on it. You know how you're always looking back on the projects you've done and you're thinking, I would do it differently now?
Right, sure.
I do that all the time, too. And this one specifically, I have some bones to pick on. I'm giving a keynote at JS Congress in Munich in November. Going to be right alongside people like my favorite Lynn Clark. So exciting. Mm-hmm. I want to show how much faster and better I can make this site today. For instance, it's got jQuery in there. It's got Modernizer. It's got, it's using Scroller, a JavaScript library that causes parallax to happen. It's also got another library, Waypoints.js, which checks to see, I'm using it here to change some classes depending on which part of the book is in viewport. And these are some pretty heavy assets, and they're not the most performant. Mm-hmm. They're not the most performant for scrolling or anything like that. And we have new APIs. We have new features in the browser that completely negate most of these.
You are doing things in this thing, in this website, that feel like modern. Like I don't know if the term is scroll jacking, but as you scroll, things are happening.
Right. That is called scroll jacking.
Yeah. It's like very common. It's common now, but when this came out, that was not something that was really widely seen. At least I didn't see it much.
It was very popular when this was first published way back in the day. Everyone wanted to know how to do parallax, which was what they later came to call scroll jacking. Mm. Pretty much any time something happens in accordance with the user's scroll, you'll hear it referred to as scroll jacking mm-hmm. or parallax. Parallax is a visual effect where something in the foreground or a 2.5D presentation moves faster than things in the background, things moving at different rates. Scroll jacking is whenever you're using the scroller to change or changing the behavior of the scroll bar. There are many different kinds. There's like scroll triggering, which is when something only happens when you've scrolled to a certain point. There's scroll linking, when maybe you've tied the scroll bar to a progression, like as you're scrolling down the side of a site, you might see, you've seen like when you're reading an article and as you scroll, there's a bar at the top that shows you how far away from the end you are. That's an example of scroll linking. So it can be used for both nefarious, evil purposes, like, you know, parallax you can't turn off that makes some user sick.
Right.
And it can also be used for great purposes, like a useful bar that shows you how far you are through a book. But in this case, it's really touching the DOM a lot. Scroller, the library, is by hand updating these different elements with CSS properties using a scroll event listener, and it's really not that efficient. Mm. Now we've got some other things that are much more efficient, and I'm looking forward to showing people how they can work.
I'm looking at Alice, and her eyes having like an idle animation, and she's sitting on a park bench, and I think maybe you are sitting next to her reading JavaScript for Designers.
That is not me. That is her older sister. I only wish I looked that cool.
Okay. And I noticed that there's some jQuery on the site. Are you animating her eyes with CSS or with JavaScript at this point?
With CSS. The bulk of the animations on here are CSS driven. Mm-hmm. The only time I use any JavaScript to drive animations is when I'm changing classes to change her mood as she's falling down the rabbit hole. And also for the parallax effect, where her descent down the rabbit hole is controlled by your scroll position.
Oh, okay. Because I'm scrolling, and like you say, the background is going fast. It's almost like gears on a bicycle, where I'm moving my scroll wheel at a constant speed. She's at one gear, and the background is at a much lower gear.
Right. And you'll notice that she's also changing as you scroll down. Yeah. That's because the class on her container is changing. It's changing her background position attribute. So what I would do that today is I would be using Intersection Observer to check to see which mood she should be having instead of using Waypoints, which has to listen to a bunch of scroll events. Intersection Observer is an interesting API. It was created largely because people wanted to optimize the behavior of ads. Mm-hmm. But of course, the first thing that was going to happen was it was going to be co-opted by creative coders and interaction developers as well. Mm-hmm. So it's very useful in that regards. It tells you when two elements on the screen have intersected. And you can use it to listen for all kinds of things. I've seen it being used in systems to check to see when something has fully loaded. I'm using jQuery on here to check to see when the page is loaded, but I could also use Intersection Observer to just see when all the images have intersected with the window. I've seen it being used also to help with getting just the, what is it? The most important CSS that you'll see that's just above the fold, the stuff that must be loaded first. I've seen Intersection Observer used in automated systems to just find that CSS that applies and then just spit that out separately as a style sheet that can be embedded in the page for faster performance.
So forgive my ignorance on this one here, but I see SVG in some of the CSS where it's like background URL something something SVG.
Yeah.
I see inline SVG where you can actually see the points and the data directly, the array of the data points. And then I also see what I'm assuming is SVG in a base64 encoded giant data colon image island. So I have three different ways to be doing SVG. Is there a reason for that?
Wow, you're paying attention. I am sure I had my reasons. I don't actually remember. Where are you seeing the base64? You got to tell me.
I am in style.css.
Yeah.
So I've gone to Alice in Videoland, and I've clicked on line 13, style.css.
Oh, I see
cups, and I see saucers. And, you know, it's a non-trivial amount of base64 stuff. So now there's three different ways to load your SVG. There's inline in the HTML. There's loaded in as an external resource in the CSS, and then there's base64 in the CSS. So I'm curious why that was, and then more interestingly, how you would do it in today.
I was probably using that because I wanted to have the loading cup and saucer right there immediately before all the other things had loaded.
Oh, that makes
sense. So that was a part of my most important CSS styles that must be embedded on the page. I would probably do the same thing today, but I would probably, like I said, reference. I think this is not inline. I think this is still in the CSS. I would probably pop that out of the external style sheet and just directly embed that in the header element so that it would be there available immediately.
Oh, interesting. So then it would still be inline, but it would be inline in the HTML. It would load even faster because the HTML, I see. So right now, the page
starts loading. It was loading fast in the CSS because it still didn't have to wait for an SVG to load. It was already encoded in the CSS. But I could make it even faster by not waiting for the CSS to load and just having it right there in the HTML.
Very cool. You know, it's so sad sometimes when you go and view source on a website and it's just a mess of minified stuff. It's fun to go and look at a site like this, Alice in Videoland, and view source and like go, what were they thinking? Interesting. You can actually explore the space. I kind of miss the view sourceable web.
I do too. And, you know, I started working for myself about 5 years ago. I don't work for myself anymore. I enjoy working for other people from time to time. Yeah. But back, I remember working for myself. We still sometimes would build sites like this. And now we have so many processes to optimize. We have entire tooling pipelines to optimize delivery. It's impressive. I mean, it's great, but it's also, I wish we would also just build lighter weight sites by default, says the lady who loves building interactive experiences on her weekends.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. And if any of your listeners would like to learn more about animation on the web, I would love to invite them to join the Animation at Work Slack at slack.animationatwork.com. Got all kinds of people of all levels of skill. And we also have a newsletter, which you can find at webanimationweekly.com.
Fantastic. I'm going to put all of these links in the show notes. And then also remember the coupon Hansel, H-A-N-S-E-L, to get 10% off the book. Fantastic. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott. Take care.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.